Welcome to another episode of Thoughts of a Techno Wizard, Techno Shaman, and Narco Punk, and other stuff. It is Saturday, October 14th, 9:30 a.m., 2023. And yes, unfortunately, I did miss doing a Friday the 13th episode because it was raining yesterday. But it is not raining today. Still quite cloudy, but hopefully it gets a lot better. Dries up a little bit and stuff, because a friend of mine wanted to do a field day today, so hopefully that goes through. That would be fun. But there's a number of things I want to talk about today, and let's see if we can get to them. I don't want to do too long of an episode. I got a lot of other stuff I want to do this morning, so we'll see. So I wanted to talk about, I think number one, some, I guess, apologies and critiques to my beautiful listeners and things like that. And number two, I wanted to talk about some, of course, things I've been doing and stuff like that, which goes into number three, some thoughts I had about specifically things like identity, from this podcast I was listening to, and related to other, you know, other stuff. And number four, better ways to design better futures, of course, but specifically for, you know, better opportunities for XR based on my initial very quick hands-on experience with the Meta Quest 3, as well as just watching other reviews about it. And some story ideas I've had about creating better futures. I think those are the main things that I want to discuss. Let's see if I get to all of them and remember them. So first, apologies. Shout out to some of my listeners. I don't know if they want me to say their name in the context of this, but I talked about many times, but especially the last episode or two, my experiences with religion and, you know, the problems therein. And it seems like I, you know, unintentionally created this sort of existential, I'm not sure if it was a crisis per se, but, you know, a little bit of a problem there with people questioning their own religion. And though I do I do kind of want to do that, at the same time, I do think I hold some responsibility over, you know, how that is done. Because I know that is that can be a painful process, right? For me, it was a long process. Like, it took 5-10 years. And even today, like, I still have, like, this is why I talk about it, because I still have, you know, some things I'm dealing with through that, you know? So I know it's something that shouldn't be taken lightly, right? And when I share my own experiences with this, it's not necessarily, you know, meant to kind of like destroy your sense of faith or whatever, but it is meant to, you know, share some other perspectives and hopefully, you know, gradually help you find your own ideas, right? Whether that be with the religion that you're with or with something else, because I do think that the vast majority of people, you know, specifically religious people, but really all people, have the beliefs that they have, not because they actually enjoy those beliefs or believe those beliefs, like, seriously, but simply because that's what they were taught, right? That's how they were raised. That's what they thought to be as normal. And so they don't often have an opportunity to critique it, to explore it, to, you know, decide for themselves if this is something that I, whatever your sense of self is, you know, truly want to believe. And I think, you know, it is helpful, and I hope it is helpful for people to hear, you know, my own experiences and to compare that with their own and see where they want to go with that, you know. But yeah, all that to say that I do want that to be, I guess I just want to be more empathetic with that, right? More caring, more. I want to be able to introduce these ideas without kind of throwing people down a rabbit hole by themselves, right? And if you feel like you're dealing with this sort of thing, then reach out. You know, I would love to, you know, talk through it, share more of my own experiences in a more, you know, directed way, right? We can have an actual conversation about that. And yeah. Also, I want to apologize to who this person is a listener, but they're not, like, the reason why I want to apologize is because they have their own newsletter, and I feel like I kind of tore it apart. And we talked about it, you know, together, but I do want to kind of put this out here too. Is like, so they had a newsletter where they were, you know, sharing advice from some folks that personally I really don't agree with at all. And for me, I try to make it clear when we were talking as well, but I do think, you know, just talking about that in this field can be helpful to myself and others. But like, I was being critical of the subject of, you know, their piece, as well as the, you know, the relationships they were drawing between, you know, the advice that they were trying to give that can be applied on the personal level versus what I see as advice that is often applied on the organizational level, right? And a lot of my critiques were very quite frankly critical of their subject and of the applications of those tips, right? But, and looking back at it, I do feel like I spent too much time, you know, kind of just vomiting out my my own, you know, problems with their subject, as well as like did a poor job of explaining, you know, the problems I see with the critique or with their writing, in a more constructive way, right? I think I did have some elements of that, of like constructive critique that they said was helpful. But all that to say, like, I feel like a big part of that was because I simply don't get to talk about, you know, my critiques to that type of person, you know, ever. Sometimes I talk about it here on the podcast and the journal, but that's about it, right? Like, the people I have in my life, like, they all share kind of fairly similar things, similar ideas. Right, I don't really have anybody in my life who like holds any sort of respect for these types of people. So I don't really get to have any sort of back and forth, you know, with that. It's just, you know, people who also agree that, yeah, we don't care about that. We don't care about that type of person, right? Which is fine, but at the same time, it does, like, because I enjoy having these sorts of discussions, and, you know, seeing if there is anything that I missed about this person, right? About these types of folks. It does make it so that when these opportunities come around, or if you see these opportunities, when these things come around, when I see somebody who I do care about, like, talking about this person in a positive regard, a lot of the kind of frustrations and the stuff that I wanted to talk about comes out at once. And I don't think that is helpful. And I wish I was able to, you know, do that more strategically. Yeah. So, shout out to that person. They know who they are. Again, we had a great discussion. It wasn't, like, crazy or anything like that. But I just feel like I could have done better with that. Um, Yeah. And let me see, was there anything else? I think that was the main elements there. Like I said, I do think, there's some important. Oh, that's another thing. Yeah, I knew there's something. So, something else I want to communicate in that conversation as well is the fact that my own brain, like the way different people think, right, kind of impacts how they see the world, right? And of course that's obvious, but what I mean by that is in their article, they were trying to distill personal kind of advice, right, from organizational examples, right? And to me, that was just like confusing in a way. Like, even though I get it, to me, it also seems like, I don't know. Honestly, it seems like a bad example, a bad way to use it, because I constantly I'm seeing the ways in which this advice, when applied organizationally, can be very destructive and is often very destructive, right? And though it can be helpful on the personal level, even then, there's, some steep caveats and some, important ways to recognize when to apply these skills and when not to, and this, that, and the other. And I don't think I made clear why I think this is so important, right? And why I see it this way, right? Because for me personally, and I think I asked them too, like, are you sure? Like, how many other people were confused about this, right? And they said nobody else except for me. So I was like, huh, that's interesting. because like as a designer, I'm constantly thinking about like how other people may take this the wrong way, all right, or may not see this as you thought they'd see this, right? I'm constantly like, that's a big part of my job, and there's always more I'm learning about that. And it's tricky because you can't really predict that. But there are, kind of things you can do to kind of minimize that as best you can. And I'm wondering here if this is something to where, all those other people truly didn't, see any sort of confusion between that, or are they taking it for granted, or, is it, am I really that much of a weirdo? Like, I don't dismiss any of these possibilities. And but yeah, in regards to like me being the weirdo, I don't disregard that too, especially because I know that I tend to see things in an interrelated way. Like everything is connected, right? And so, applying something here will also affect how you apply it there, or the way you read, something here in a certain context will also impact something there in a different context. And I know I'm kind of being vague here, but the point is that this applies to pretty much anything. Like, I see everything as interrelated. And the practice of sort of, separating things out and trying to be, I guess the word for that is analytical, right? To me, is very, what's the word I want to use here? Not quite disingenuous, but like, what's the word I want to use here? It just does not fit, right? It doesn't really make much sense to me in the regards that it can be extremely reductive, right? If I can say it like that. And by that I mean it often, avoids certain nuance, which is funny because they were claiming me of, not seeing the nuance there, which is funny. And that's a big reason why I know I didn't communicate well enough, which is a big thing for me. Like, I rather over communicate than under. But that's why I know I did fail there, because like my whole thing is trying to show the nuance, right? Trying to show how, just because you might find something good from a person that may not be all that good, right? Who often does things that are, you know, bad. You may see that on one level as quote unquote nuanced, because, you know, you're getting the good from the bad, or you're seeing kind of quote unquote both sides, right? But I feel like that conversation is kind of like level one, right? Or like, I don't want to say that in a, that's kind of a mean way to say it. I'm not trying to hierarchize it. I do think that sort of outlook on nuance is a sort of, you know, common way to not see nuance, if that makes sense, right? Like, it seems nuanced, right? On the surface, it seems like a nuanced approach, right? This idea of both sides, and, you know, everybody has good and bad and this, that, and the other, and you just want to get the good from the bad and stuff like that, or these sorts of ideas or these sorts of approaches may seem like a nuanced approach. But the thing they often ignore is the kind of macro lens there, right? And even the micro lens to an extent, right? The fact that if you try to both side something, or if you try to extract the good from the bad, you can very often miss the greater context, right? The reason why, you know, that quote-unquote balanced approach, or that supposedly balanced approach, isn't actually balanced, right? It goes back to what I was saying about the left and right politics quite a while ago, right? The idea, especially in America, where you can be in the middle by not being left or right, right? That seems like a nuanced approach. That seems like, I'm just, you know, why can't both of these people be more sensical, whatever, right? Be in the middle. But the reality of America, especially, anybody that's versed in politics or economics or anything like that will tell you this as well, is that the entirety of the American political system itself skews far to the right, right? In the sense that the very project of nation states, and specifically of capitalism, right, in America especially, skews the entire Overton window, right? Skews the entire realm of thinking to one side. And so if you're in the middle of that once of that side, right? Even if there's left and right of that side, of that spectrum, the middle is still to the right. It's still unbalanced compared to, you know, the greater realm of ideas that exists in the world, or in especially throughout human history, right? So if you look at the broader context, you realize that your so-called nuanced approach is actually not nuanced, right? It's falling into the same kind of propaganda that we're being told, that we're being taught to believe is kind of true. Like, oh yeah, these far-right weirdos, but even people on the left are too far, you know, gone, right? They're whatever. You gotta fall right here in the middle. That approach in and of itself is something that is created, and something that is itself extremely biased towards that side. And I say bias here, not in a idea that, oh, you can be unbiased, because that's another side to this, right? The very idea that you can be unbiased is in and of itself similar to the idea that you can be in the middle, right? The truth is, there is always a bias. The question is, what is your bias, right? Just the very fact that you're human and you have a subjective experience means that you are biased, right? And this leads into what I was going to talk to next, but before I move on, I just want to say that doesn't, I'm not saying that you can't find the good in the bad, that you can't find, you know, some valuable information from any source, from even sources that are extremely problematic, right? But that does mean you have to do more work, in my opinion, right? And honestly, I feel like my opinion is a kind of cop out there. I want to say that in a, if you want to share information from sources that are dubious, right, then it necessitates more action. It necessitates more attempts, more effort, right, to share that information in a truly nuanced way, or in a, I don't want to say truly, in a more nuanced way than even you think you are doing, right? Like if I'm sharing information from, I'm going to take an extreme example here. Now I'll take a less extreme example, right? If you want to share some good advice from Hitler, for instance, right? I do think that is possible, right? Because there's a way in which Hitler came to power that is very apropos to our current situation, right? There's a way in which he was able to, you know, stir the masses in a way that is applicable to many different situations, even if you're not trying to, you know, be a Nazi, right? But in so doing, you have to be super, super clear about what you're talking about, right? Show the greater context. Oh, Hitler, you know, is this type of person, blah, 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 right? He was in this greater system, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, this is how he was able to do that, right? And we might be able to take some things from that and apply it to this situation, but you also have to be careful of this, that, and the other, right? And yes, sometimes it does take more words, but maybe not, right? Because maybe you could figure out a concise way to explain all this. But yes, it also is much harder, right? Because being concise is extremely difficult. This is the reason why I do this podcast, because I don't really want to be concise at this moment in time, right? I feel like this is the process of me learning how to be concise, is talking about it, getting it out of my head, and then going back and writing about it later. And maybe writing another thing about it that's more short, that's shorter, right? There's this several, it takes several iterations. But my point here is that, you know, if you want to be more nuanced, then it takes a greater effort than you even think you are currently applying. Especially when you're dealing with sources that are dubious in nature, right? That have demonstrable, if that's how you say that word, right? That have demonstrable examples of them being extremely problematic, right? Especially if they're, you know, extremely well resourced person and can unequivocally do things to, you know, bend the public will, right? To bend the public will, but also the public perspective of their actions, right? The public record, even, of their actions, right? This is something that you see throughout all of history, where powerful people are able to do these sorts of things. It takes a lot of effort to do that. And I feel like I didn't explain all of that, any of that, very well. So, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I did want to say a less kind of extreme example. So, you know, you could take somebody like, I don't know why Mother Teresa came to mind, but that is a sort of extreme example in some ways. But I guess that's the other side of the spectrum. Somebody that seems super positive, super, you know, super altruistic and all this other stuff. But then you delve deep, or something comes out and you realize, oh, this person was actually fairly problematic, to say the least. But that's kind of an extreme example, too. You know what? I'll say somebody like my father, right? Somebody like an everyday person who is honestly not very... not very great in that matter. In the terms of, like, I talked about this many times, like, my father is a very problematic person, has very problematic takes, pretty sure he's narcissistic in an immature way, and I've had a lot of difficulties with him growing up, right? But nonetheless, I'm still able to learn from him, but usually by example of what not to do, right? But even without that, there are some things that he does that I do, you know, try to emulate, like the way in which he's able to be very charming and communicate with people, or not really communicate, but like he can be very boisterous, right, and spark up conversations with anybody, right? And I do find that, you know, as something to learn from, to take, right? Even if I disagree with almost everything else that he does, right? But when I do that, I'm sorry, I had to say, I'm immature. But anyways, when I do that, I have to take into consideration the greater context, right? Like, the reason why he's able to be that way is because he believes, I'm not even going to get into that, right? Because it doesn't really matter what he believes. Or maybe some would say it does. But what I want to specifically call out is that when I try to emulate these aspects of him, right, I'm also keeping in mind, right, the problems therein, even when he's, you know, sparking up conversations. Maybe he's taking too much of the other person's time, right? Maybe the other person doesn't want to have a 5-minute conversation turn into a 30-minute conversation, right? Or maybe, you know, he's making off-color jokes, or, you know, maybe he's being too loud. Like, there's always elements of even the stuff that I'm taking that is positive, that is helpful, that can be, you know, problematic in different situations. And again, yes, you may want to be concise. Yes, you may want to say, oh, no, you know, just take that and run with it, right? Or take that and you can figure out the rest. But the devil is in the details, right? And I think this is another problem with being too concise, with being too, I don't know, idealistic, I suppose, and the way that you try to take something from one context and put it into another, is that the context matters, right? And if you try to take it out of one context and apply it to another, it may not work anymore, right? It may get worse, or maybe even gets better, but in a way in which it becomes unfamiliar, right? Where you no longer, it doesn't really apply the same way in which you took it, right? Because the very process of changing it from one context to another, or the process of applying it from one context to another, changes that thing, right? And now seeming a little philosophical, but, you know, life is philosophy in many ways. Or at least, like, understanding life, or at least, like, trying to you know, grasp it in a way. But anyways, yeah. I feel like I did a poor job explaining all of that. And, yeah. So shout out to you. And hopefully we can have some more conversations that are more constructive. And anybody else listening, you know, just take care to, you know, try to get to the point that you're actually trying to describe. You know, worry about that first, and then, you know, get into the details later. Or if you have other, you know, portions that you want to vent out, try to make that clear. Like, hey, I just want to vent on this part. You know, let me just put this out here. Right. I think that's the biggest problem too. Like, I didn't make clear, like, I was just venting here, but also here is a thing for you to here's a point of constructive criticism versus here is a point of just venting for me, right? Making stuff like that more clear when you're having conversations with folks, especially over text. But yeah, anyways, a lot of that does go into the third thing I want to talk about, I think. Was it the second? Godly, I already forgot. And I'm already 30 minutes into this, so I'm probably not going to get to all four, whatever those were. But the next thing I want to talk about is... I want to talk about what I was doing this week. Ah, that's fine. Whatever. I'm going to skip that. Nothing too major. Just, you know, just the usual, mostly. Yeah. So I wanted to... just lose it, have it, my old trains of thoughts just going all over the place. But one second. Okay, I had to drink some water and refocus my thoughts. So I had to listen to this great podcast, talking about, and I did all that, and yet I didn't actually look at the podcast. Goodness. But yeah, it was talking about the idea of self and identity, and I found this conversation really interesting. But of course, there are elements that I feel like was kind of missing from it. And I know they have a book, and I'm probably might check out the book. But I know I'm almost certain that the book probably didn't, you know, talk about these other elements I'm going to talk about today, just because most people don't really think about this because they don't have a anarchistic lens. They don't have a they don't really see the world that way. But here, it's called Daniel Pink and Brian Lowry Aren't Sure That You Exist by The Next Big Idea. So yeah, Daniel Pink has this book talking about, I'm trying to get the title of the book, Selfless, The Social Creation of You. Is that what it's called? Yeah, Selfless, The Social Creation of You by Brian Lowry. Hope that's how you pronounce his name. So yeah, I really like this podcast. It was talking about how the self is not what you think it is, right? Like, often, or just think about it for a second, right? Before I move on, feel free to pause. What do you think the self is, right? What do you think? Who do you think you are? Your identity. What makes that up? Now you can resume. So, make this more interactive, you know. So he was talking about how, and I'm of course grossly paraphrasing, so please go listen to the podcast, go read the book if you want, whatever. But he was talking about how the self is very much constructed by the social relationships that we have, right? Like, the idea of the self and identity is in of itself a social construct, right? It's not something that's purely individual. It's not something that's purely personal, right? Because if you think, and it can be something as broad as like gender and race and things like that, right? Or as specific as, you know, your job or your family relationships and this, that, and the other, right? And even to this point of like your membership to a nation. Right, and I'll get to that shortly. But he was saying how the idea of self is often created by your relationships with other people, both by how you, not only is it like how you, what you believe in yourself to be, what you believe yourself to be, but also what other people believe you to be. Right? Hey, he told the example of the infamous Rachel Dolezal. So to those that don't know, Rachel Dolezal is a person who grew up calling themselves black. Was a black person, right? Then it come to find out her parents were white, and she was raised in a, you know, kind of typically, you know, white kind of neighborhood or things like that. But she says she always identified as black. And so he was saying that, you know, even though many people would disagree, and maybe rightfully so, he's making an argument that she was black, and then she was not black, right? Right? And that she was black because, not only because she believed so, but because people also believed she was black, all right? Like, oh, this, I probably skipped that, shouldn't have to skip that part, but when she was growing up, like, in college and afterwards and stuff like that, she was like often involved in like black communities, and, you know, I think it was like a board or something like that, board member or whatever on NAACP. It's like a, you know, for those not in America, it's like a black community, national community type of thing. And, you know, she married a black man, had a black child and all this other stuff. So for a long period of time, not just she believed she was black, other people believed she was black, right? And for those, again, for those that don't know, especially who are not in America, or not in, like, Western nations, but, like, there's a very big, both, well, quite frankly, yeah, problem with colorism in America, and especially in black communities, right? Where you can be considered black, or rather the idea of black, it, right, in and of itself I mentioned before, is a social construct, right? Like, it's not something in your DNA or something like that. Like we know that there's all sorts of phenotypical differences that happens across the realm. And in places like Africa, right, the genetics are so wide and so varied. Like, it's the most genetically diverse place in the world. And so you have, like, the palest people and the darkest people, the shortest people and the tallest people, right? So you have, in the continent of Africa, right, many of them don't consider themselves black, right? They're just of a certain ethnicity, right? It's only during the diaspora, right, where people are taken from this place and put in another place, that this construct of black, you know, kind of is created. And especially in America, blackness is associated with socioeconomic status, right? With poverty, because of course we were all enslaved when we came, right? And so, you know, portions of that still remain. But the point here is that, you know, she considered herself black, and other black people consider herself black. And other white people, right? And the reason why she was able to do that is because she had just enough. Well, I'm not even going to say, right? Because I honestly don't know. Like, I haven't seen Rachel Dawes on the wild, but I'd imagine that she has just enough racial ambiguity to pull that off, right? I don't know if she, I doubt that she, like, I don't know if she tanned her skin or anything like that, or like, but nonetheless, there are plenty of light skinned black people who are so light-skinned that they basically look white, like, right? And that, like, you know, you can't tell from just looking at somebody that they're black, oftentimes, or sometimes. And, you know, that's probably why she was able to do that, even though she was born from two, you know, white parents. Like, there's such thing as white passing. And it's especially prevalent in mixed communities, like in you know, families with, you know, one white parent, one black parent. But it also happens, again, it could happen with two black parents, right? Two stereotypically black parents could have a child that is white passing, right? For a number of reasons. But yeah, the point here is that her identity of like being black was created not just by herself, but by the community. And so when people found out that she had two white parents and stuff like that, almost nobody in the black community considered, and I don't like to say black community, right? Because it's not really a community, but almost nobody who considers themselves black will consider, you know, Rachel Dolezal black, right? Especially after realizing that she has two, you know, white parents, because typically, especially in America, you know, what makes you black is your upbringing, right? Is the people who raised you, right? The community that you're in. And he does make the example of, like, what about a, you know, a typically white kid raised with, adopted by black parents, you know, and a typically black neighborhood? Would they consider themselves white or black, you know? Typically not, which is interesting, right? For a number of reasons. But he said the other way too. What if a black kid was raised by white parents? Would they consider themselves white or black? And typically, even though they might call themselves white, many people would consider them black, right? Because especially in America, blackness is, I like this this joke that I'm gonna butcher, but like, if the cops pull you over because they think you're colored, like, you're black, right? Like, you know, that's a kind of flippant answer, but the point here is that, yeah, blackness, a lot of blackness is socially constructed, and especially a lot of blackness is kind of steeped in the things that one deals with, the adversities. There we go. I don't know why I was losing that word, but the adversities that one deals with growing up just because of how you look, right? And so for a lot of people, oh my gosh, is it still recording? Okay, yeah, sorry. I didn't see the timer going. For a lot of people, the idea of somebody being born to white parents and yet considering themselves black is very anger-inducing, because it's highly likely that that person has never experienced racism, has never experienced somebody looking at them and saying some off the wall shit, or, you know, being pulled over by the cops because you're black, or, you know, or being in a neighborhood where you feel like you don't belong, or, you know, all these other things that, you know, black people, quote unquote black people, typically experience, right? And even if you didn't experience that growing up, which is highly unlikely, even if you're wealthy, a wealthy quote unquote black person, right, and you didn't experience much of that growing up, there's almost certainly you experienced some level of, you know, racism by your peers or other folks. And it's sort of an unescapable thing due to the system that we live in. And so I can understand why, you know, people would never have considered her black if they would have known. But that's the thing, right? They didn't know. And so that kind of shows you, too. It's kind of like a open experiment that shows how identity is socially constructed. Same thing with gender, right? The very idea that you can be, you know, that you are, for instance, a man or a woman, right, is in and of itself an expression of not just yourself, but also how other people see you, right? A big problem with how, you know, bi folks or trans folks or anybody like that experiences the world is that other people don't believe them or don't want to believe them, right? And he says something that is really good in this regard too. He was saying that not only is this like the reason why there's so much problems with identity, especially with people who are, you know, non-conforming to the stereotypical ideas of identity, is that it also opens up the self, like you, like the person who is onlooking, to the idea that their sense of identity is constrained. Which is funny, because I think I mentioned this before too, right? The reason why a lot of people, you know, hate, or at least claim that they hate, you know, I'll say, yeah, probably hate trans people and stuff like that, is because they themselves are scared, right? They themselves are scared of the idea that, oh, wow, I don't, like, my idea of what it means to be man or woman or whatever is limited. It doesn't have to be this way, right? I could be something else, right? And a lot of people don't want to have to confront that, right? Because it's scary, right? Not only because it's scared of change, but also it feels insecure, right? It feels, you know, terrifying. And the same principle can apply to nation states, right? The reason why people who identify themselves as American, especially those who consider themselves very patriotic, can be so terrible is because, you know, their idea, their identity of themselves as an American or as any, you know, nation state is constructed by this somewhat narrow idea of what it means to be an American or what it means to be, you know, X type of person from X country or whatever, right? And if you let all these people in, that means that you're letting them change who you think you are, right? That means you're letting them into your family, right? Which has a whole different connotation, right? Which means a whole set of other things that many people aren't prepared to do or to be. And so people can be very nasty and visceral about that, right? But the thing that I noticed in, you know, across this, in this podcast, is that he doesn't mention how, even though he did mention how, like, nation states, like, the idea of nation states was constructed, right? Like a lot of people like to assume that we've always had nations and states and stuff like that, but no, it's fairly somewhat recently constructed for a number of reasons. He kind of just kind of, you know, quickly listed like one or two off, but a big thing that, again, this goes into the context element that I find like kind of almost irresponsible for people, especially of his nature, like people who are learned, right, is to ignore the fact that nation states was constructed as a means of controlling identity, right? It wasn't just as a means of administration or an accounting and stuff like that. It was specifically meant to control people, right? It was specifically meant for a person in a higher realm of power to say, you know, these people or this land, this area belongs to me, right? And because of that, this is how you should act, and this is, you know, how you can't act and stuff like that, right? This is who we allow, this is who we don't allow, right? It wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just this, you know, I don't know how to describe it. Like, I feel like people kind of assume it's just like, oh yeah, there's a good reason for you know, why we're nation states. It was the best thing we can do. It wasn't, right? And in fact, we have so much data that shows that in the beginning of almost every nation state, of almost every occasion where there was a city that became a state, that became, you know, nation or whatever, or it may not be exactly like that, but in almost every occasion where there was a wider group of people who then segmented themselves off and created a city and things like that, there was almost always a decline in their health and safety. And there was an incline in war and xenophobia and things like that, right? Because the very act, the very nature of delineating yourself away from other people, right, creates in it, and he said this portion, right, it creates in it a reason to fight other people, a reason to exclude other people, right? Because again, if a nation, he said at this point, where a nation state can often has stronger influence on you than your family or friends, which is amazing for somebody like that to say that in a thing like this. But to me, it just like really shows it's a big opportunity for an anarchistic lens to get in there and really talk about what that means, right? What does it mean for a nation state to have a greater influence on you, on your sense of self, than your, you know, familial and friendly relationships? And to me, it shows that, you know, the method of control that nation states have on us is extremely powerful, right? The reason why it's so effective is not because it offers up some, you know, benefits that we can't have anywhere else. Like, you can have pretty much all these things that we get from nation states anywhere in almost any other configuration of, you know, society. But what it does extremely well, to go back to, you know, what you can learn from different things in the beginning, what it does extremely well is create an exclusive club. It creates a reason to band up with people who you may not actually know personally in order to, you know, fight people who you also don't know just as much, or even you might even know them more than people very close to you. But if they are from a different quote-unquote nation, if they're from a different people, if they're from some other place that, you know, you see as separate from yourself, as not of your origin or whatever, then you have many people will have a bigger reason to fight those people and band up with, you know, the people who identifies your nation state, right? And we see this in things like, for instance, the army, right? They even showed, I've talked about this before too, right? There's data that shows that a lot of people don't want to shoot other people, right? Even as recent as, like, I think it was World War I, where there was only like 20% of people or 20% of the of people who were shooting actually shot another human being. Right? The vast majority of people would just shoot in the air or just run away or just not do anything they can to not hit the other person on the other side. Until they created a training regime where you identify with your brothers, right? Your men in arms as your family, as this group, as this exclusive group that you must protect, right? After that, they had like a 80%, you know, bump, well, like up to 80% or more of people would shoot the other person, would shoot other folks, you know, without, you know, hesitation. Because they didn't want to kill the other person. They just wanted to protect their people, right? And it also goes to show, right? I mentioned this in another podcast, like family is kind of a weak way of bonding, right? To some people it seems very, very strong, like you have to do this because your family, whatever. But honestly, when it comes down to it, I think many people would agree that if your family doesn't feel like family, if you don't feel connected, if you don't feel like you can, you know, that they're protecting you and that you're protecting them and stuff like that, then many people would be like, yeah, it's whatever. Nah. Yeah, family in name and name only, right? What really makes family is the bonds of like belief systems, right? The idea that we all agree on this set of things. And we all can, we all want to belong to this set of beliefs, right? That's usually what creates a stronger sense of family, a stronger sense of connection, and a stronger identity, shared identity, right? So, yeah, I did find it kind of, again, maybe disingenuous, but maybe just more lacking of nuance, right? Lacking of context, that the idea that, you know, people identify with nation states, like that belief system is not just a thing of, or rather, it doesn't have to be this way, I guess, let's just say. I don't know, I feel like that was a very poor way of saying it, but this does lead me to the last thing I want to talk about. and I might have to make another section, because I don't know if I'm going to cover it in 8 minutes, I don't know, we'll see. But it goes into the different stories I want to tell about the world, right? I do think that there is a way in which we can use this phenomenon of identity that's usually found in nation states, but, you know, keep it more open and flexible and things like that, right? Because we do see, once again, in the data and historical data, we do see examples of people living in fairly strong communities that were also fairly open. Like, for instance, the Bantu people. I used to talk about them a lot, right? The Bantu people were a group of folks in Africa, pre-colonial Africa. I think they even date back to, like, quote-unquote prehistoric, which is, I hate that term, but they date back thousands and thousands of years, right? And it's these people who would often migrate around Africa and introduce new ideas to other people, but also take in ideas from other folks, right? And they had a very clear kind of culture and very clear cultural impact on Africa. You can see how they impacted each place that they stopped at, or each place that they passed and stuff like that. But you can also see how they changed over the years, over the generations, right? And to me, I do want to study more into them for this purpose. But to me, that seems like a great example of how one can have a strong sense of culture, a strong sense of shared identity, without being extremely exclusive, right? Extremely xenophobic, right? And this is true with a lot of nomadic cultures, but even with some I don't want to say settled cultures, because some of them, that's probably the difference, right? Some of them weren't super settled. They would just rotate very slowly, right? Like, they would stay in an area for decades, or even like 100 or 200 years, until the land, you know, was dying out, and then they would move a little bit, and then they would come back, right, after a few more generations for the land to replenish, right? So it's not quite nomadic, but also not quite settled. But anyways, either way, with many of these cultures, they were actually very welcoming and open to new people joining the culture, right? They just had a way in which people could do so. They had a tradition. They had rituals, right? They had things that they did that said, hey, if you want to join this culture, fine, cool. Do this, right? You know, here's how you can do so. And it's not the same. I want to make clear, right? This is not the same as because some people say, oh, yeah, this is what we're trying to say with immigration, immigrants, right? Coming in illegally, right? No, right? The you having to fill out some paperwork and, you know, pay some fees and wait, you know, decades or whatever, you know, years, if not decades, to join, to become an American, right? The proper way. It's not the same thing as a ritual, right? It's not the same thing as a set of traditions that everybody does, right? Because nobody in America who's born in America has to do those things. So it's literally not an American tradition, right? It's a barrier. If instead, so here's my point, right? I think we can have a place, an anarchistic world, where people identify themselves as American or any nation, any previously nation nationality, right? If they truly believe that, oh, they really like this idea of being American, whether it be whatever that means for them, they can do that. But they don't have the power, right, to stop people from moving out or even from people moving in. And by that, I mean, like, if people try to move into your area, you can't just be like, you can't just jail them or something like that, right? Like, if they can find a place to live there, they can find a place to live. But they might not be of your community, and that's fine too, right? If they want to be accepted in your community, that means you have to have a set of rituals, a set of traditions, a set of things that you all regularly do that shows who you are, and people can decide if they want to do those things to become a part of your community, right? And in so doing, you can have a more clear definition of what it actually means to be an American or any, again, I'm just using America because that's where I am, but it holds true for pretty much anything else, any other sense of identity. And we could probably do a longer episode really delving into different sense of identity, seeing where this might work, where this might not work. But the point is, yeah, I'm gonna do another section because I really wanted to talk about some other things in this regard. But yeah, I do think we can have an anarchistic world where there are no nation states, but there are many, many types of communities, and some of them have very strong sense of identity. Some of them may consider themselves, for instance, American. There might even be different iterations or different versions of American, right? They might be the the American West, right? The Western Americans who really like the idea of the Wild West and try to bring that into their definition of America. There might be the urban Americans who really like the idea of, you know, cities and things like that and try to, you know, bring that in there or whatever, right? But with any of these, they have a clear definition, like their sense of identity is not based on some, you know, it's not merely based on some borders or some paperwork or taxes or having the police be able to beat down your door. It's based on their actual belief systems, right? The actual rituals, the actual things that they do to be that type of person, to have that type of culture. And if other folks want to join, right, then they can choose to do that, to have that, to do those actions, to be part of that culture. And let me stop this and start a new one. Okay, so to continue this conversation, so I wanted to say that, yeah, I think these are the type of stories I want to tell, right? I want to tell like some stories where you can see people living in a solarpunk anarchistic world, but it's not too dissimilar to our current life, right? I think this is something that many people miss, and this goes from some other things I've been listening to, watching over the past week or couple of weeks, and so is the reality that people crave structure, and people are. I wanted to say that I was kind of hesitating to say this. I know there's this idea that people are scared of change, right? But I don't think that's exactly it. I think people are scared of the unknown, right? And for very good reason, right? Because the unknown holds unknown dangers, right? Unknown risks, things that you can't predict, things that you can't plan for, things that you know, can very much end you for any number of reasons, right? It's a very instinctual fear, a very understandable one. But I don't think that necessarily is the same as people scared of change, because I do think people crave change, right? People crave experiencing new things. People crave, you know, exploration and adventure, right? The reason why we like to read stories and, you know, play games and all this other stuff is because we want a little bit of change, right? We want a little bit of something different, right? New foods and things like that, right? We like that. But it also goes into this quote that I'm going to mangle that, you know, people like 20% of something new with like, you know, 50% of something familiar, and maybe, you know, 20 or 30 or whatever the other percentage of something that's like links together the two, or maybe different than that. But the point is, like, whenever you introduce something new, you have to couch it in the familiar, right? And then you can have something really experimental, you can have something really, you know, out there, but again, it has to be mostly enveloped in the familiar. And I think that's why a lot of people, you know, kind of see utopian and, you know, positive ideas of the future as quote unquote unrealistic. Because to them it does seem so, right? Because that's not familiar. Right? We don't live in a world where you have all these amazing things happening all the time, right? We live in a world where there's this constant, quite frankly, dystopian elements to it. And so when people see a utopian view of the future, right, they see that as inherently unreal and maybe even unrealistic, right? Something that can't happen because there's no familiarity with that. I think that's why, you know, it's so hard for people to grasp that. And so I think if we want to invite people to create a better future by envisioning a better future, we have to make that future seem more familiar, right? And I think a good way of doing that is by showing familiar things, right? By showing how a better future is a fairly familiar world, is pretty much the same that we live in, right? But doesn't have these crazy, you know, power structures, you know, controlling everything, right? Doesn't have these people hoarding all the wealth, right? Doesn't have these, you know, useless bureaucracies and this, that, and the other, right? And so another thing that I want to point out before I really get into this is how a lot of anarchism to people similarly seems very unrealistic or even, you know, dystopian or even scary, because a lot of the ideas of anarchism, but honestly usually misideas, so things that are supported by freaking, what you call them, like libertarians, right? The capitalistic ANCOMs. Wait, no, no, you call them ANCAPs. There we go. So-called anarchistic capitalists, right? It's like anything goes, right? We can do whatever we want, right? Let the market decide and stuff like that. That's not anarchism, right? Because that's literally letting some higher power decide for you, right? That's giving up the power that you have for, you know, the quote unquote market. Usually that means capitalists, right? To decide. But what true anarchism is, another part to this before I get into it, right, is people think that anarchism is, you know, without structure. It means that, again, anything goes and nobody's in charge and everything's all, there's no rules. That's another thing, right? People believe anarchism means no rules. But that's not what it means, right? It literally means without a leader, right? Or rather, without a ruler, I should say. Right, is the idea that there is nobody ruling you, nobody who tells you what to do from an authoritarian standpoint, right? And authoritarian meaning they have the power to stop you from doing something, to even punish you, right, for doing something, right? It's not so simple as, oh, authority as in somebody who is a leader in their, you know, in their industry or something like that. No, this, what's typically meant by authoritarian in this, you know, context is, you know, somebody who has the power to basically control your life, right? And so with all that, I think it becomes more clear to show the distinction of what anarchism actually is, right? The reason I personally, you know, identify with a lot of anarchism, is because it is more, because to me it is fairly structured, right? There is structure there, right? And the structure is more efficient and more, you know, egalitarian, more sensical to me than many of these other types of systems where you have one or a group of people in power, right? Anarchism does not mean without rules. You can and should have rules, but those rules are created by everybody who is involved, right? Whoever is going to be ruled by those rules has a say in those rules. And it's not just a vote. It's not just a hands up, hands down. It's a conversation, right? It's a, you know, sit down together and decide, you know, what do we do about this? Should we have a rule about this? What does that rule mean? When should this rule change? All that, right? You have these conversations. You build a consensus, right? And there are even ways to deal with people who are trying to stymie the process, who don't want to agree with everybody. Like, it's not a majority rules thing, right? People like to say, people always like to, this is going to a whole other thing. Maybe I don't want to go too much into that detail because I've talked about it before and we can, you know, do another thing with it. But the point here is that anarchism does have structure, right? And I think people need to be able to see that structure. Because a big thing that, there's this other podcast I was listening to called, I think it was called, goodness, it's a funny name, QAnon, or no, something similar. It was like making fun of the QAnon kind of podcast, but it was also kind of a riff on that. It's not exactly QAnon. I'm not a QAnon person. Goodness, no, this is terrible. Should have looked it up first. TrueAnon, there we go. Goodness, that was a real bad look there. Called TrueAnon, hilarious. But yeah, they were showing how, you know, there's been a lot of problems with a lot of like left, quote unquote leftist, especially online leftist ideas of the future, right? The idea of like this big revolution happens, and then, you know, everything is fine, right? They just destabilize the current society, and then everything works well after that, right? Like V for Vendetta, for instance, right? There's a lot of other stuff to talk about that podcast. Might do another day, but I found this very appropriate, right? Because you see that in a lot of people's ideas of the future today, whether it be on the left or the right, right? This idea that, oh, we just have to destabilize the current system and then let the new one come in, with very little explanation of what the new one is, right? And because of that, you often have this problem where even if they do win, right, or have some concessions or whatever, they don't win for long, or it's not what you expect that comes to into being. Because to borrow from, I think it was Hobbes or whatever, one of these terrible people who say, one of the economists. I don't know, but they mentioned in the podcast too the idea that the future is made from the ideas lying around or something like that, right? Which I do find is very powerful. If you are imagining a better future, if you're trying to create a better future, but you don't actually show what that better future looks like and what's there, right, then whatever is lying around is usually the pieces of the system that you just broke, right? The leftover stuff. And so that's just what comes back into power in some, but in a different fashion. Right. In fact, we can see this with a lot of the, for instance, French revolutions, and similar revolutions throughout history, where you have some group of commoners or other group like that. They didn't like how the people in power were doing things. They revolted, or rebelled or whatever, took them out of power, and then there was something worse that came next, or something that was somewhat comparative, right? Like, for instance, with American history. Or leading up to American history, from the French Revolution, stuff like that. This is like the origins of capitalism, right? There was a revolution to get rid of the aristocracy and stuff like that. And what came to power instead was mercantilism, right? Was people who were basically had similar powers to what was previously just the state just the crown or just the church. But now it was, you know, the business people, right? The entrepreneurs, they were the ones who had a lot of the power, right? Or at least the ones who were able to fund them, right? And that's fairly similar to today, right? We have a group of people who have most of the power, even though, right, we have this whole history of people trying to have create a more fair world, more egalitarian world. But yeah, the reason for that is because I feel people don't do a good enough job showing what that better future can look like and showing, you know, what we can be doing and the structures therein. So I feel like that was way too long of a way to get into this, but I want to tell a number of stories, but also I want to create worlds, right? Interactive stories or like a, I don't know, I still haven't figured out how to describe it well. So maybe I won't describe it right now, but it's not just stories, but it's also like experiences, right? Immersive experiences that you can, you know, experience. But I want to create all these things that helps people to actually see, you know, oh, this is what we can be doing instead. All right. This is what this looks like. This is what this feels like. And some examples of that is what I mentioned before, you know, with like the Borough, I can't even say that that word, but this is like organization that looks for, I think it was in the last podcast, that looks for people who are trying to, you know, be authoritarian or whatever, right? In this future where you have this a more anarchistic world, there are people who actively look to see if there's any other communities out there that are trying to, you know, limit what people can be and things like that, or who are trying to control people, right? That could be a structure that's put in place, right? And the reason why I like to say structure rather than institution is because institutions often exist for the purpose of the institution to exist, right? Or rather, there may initially be some positive or some, reason why people want to create an institution, right? But over time, of course, power conglomerates, power centralizes, power, solidified around that. And so that institution often exists just to exist and it tries to keep up its own existence rather than actually do the job that the institution was created to do, right? And I do think, and even though it is a sort of pedantic, change I'm saying here to put in structure rather than institution, there's also things that you can do to ensure that the structure, right, whatever that you're creating, the organization, does not become an institution, right? Things like allowing other people who also, agree or who also want to do this work to do this work without having to join the structure or without having to join this specific organization, right? And therefore not, bringing that power together. Not, I'm just losing my words now, but maybe that's a sign I need to, I'm talking too much, and I'm not talking effectively. But anyways, another one example of that was the idea of like, yeah, you can have these people who identify with previously nation states, right? Like America or whatever, but they are fairly intimate communities, right? There might be a group of a couple dozen people, a couple hundred people, even a couple thousand people, right? But however big the size, they all, if in order for you to join that group, right, you have to opt in, right? It's not a automatic thing that you're in this group, right? Even when you're born, right, you're not necessarily in the group, right? Because you didn't get to choose to be in the group, right? And so there are people who go through and say, oh, look, basically finding the children and seeing, do you actually want to be here or not, right? And showing other examples of this. And a good example of this, right, I know people might see that as a kind of authoritarian way, or like, why are you trying to control my children or take my children? No, it's more of a cultural thing that people do. For instance, with a lot of cultures in the past, you had a rite of passage, right? You had a... there's other terms for it, but basically, like, the rite of passage wasn't just joining whatever group that you're in. It's exploring. It's going out and exploring other places, right? Leaving your hometown and exploring the world so you can see how other people live, and then you can decide if you want to come back, right? That is a deep, I think, and I think a lot of people. Underestimate this idea, right? That people will be open to letting their kids go explore the world, because what people don't realize is that that's how humans, have evolved for a long time. And in fact, a lot of us still do this, right? That's the whole point of college in many ways. It's not just a means of education, it's a means of leaving your family, right? In order to be your own self, in order to figure out who you are. Right, but again, because of the institution of college, right, it's often controlled, it's often exclusionary, it's often that if you don't go to college, it's very difficult for you to do this at all, right? So instead, there should be structures put in place, right? There should be mechanisms put in place, tools, right, that are put in place, that are available for people to be able to go explore the world, right? And that could be funding, but also... Another thing I want to point out is that we should create a system without money, right? Because a big reason why people can't do this is because of the lack of money, right? And so this is why all of this is intermingled, right? Another structure to put in place is the idea that we don't need money to do things, right? The reason why we have money is this idea that, oh, you need to be paid in order to do work, right? But the reason why you need to be paid is not just to reward you. It's because you need to use some sort of currency in order to survive in our current society, right? But if instead we had communities where people, like I've mentioned for last year or so, right, where people are able to survive just by, you know, living there, right, where all their needs are met, where people are growing food out of the land, you know, that they're currently on, you know, where they're able to find water and all this other stuff, we're able to find all these resources that you need to live just by living on that land responsibly, right? Then you literally have no need of money for most of your needs, right? You don't have to use exclusionary source of income or this exclusionary currency system in order to survive. Yeah, I really need to end it here because I'm getting hungry and my throat is drying up, even though I've been drinking water and stuff like that. And I'm probably not even describing this stuff well. But the point here is that there's a whole bunch of stories I want to tell that I'm doing really poorly right now. But I'm going to mention a lot of them in my next newsletter, my next journal, Techno Wizardry, Techno Shamanism, whatever I'm calling that now. Do a much better job of it there because I'm gonna have time to sit down and really think things through and things like that. But yeah, if you have ideas for this sort of thing, feel free to share them, or feel free to add to, you know, the newsletter when I come out with it. You can put it in the comments or make your own version of it or whatever, or even just do your own newsletter unaffiliated. Love to get some credit, but you know, whatever. The point here is that I think we need to be, whenever we envision a better future, I think you should do some more, we should all do more work to envision not just the ideal future, as in like, oh, I'm living this great life, but the systems that allow that future to exist, right? The reason why that future is able to exist, right? If you want to create a world where people have powers or people are flying around or people are doing this, that, and the other, you know, think about the systems that allow that to happen, right? And whether or not those systems are truly sustainable in and of themselves, and the impact of them in different ways. Basically, do some world building. And I know that does make it a lot more work, but I also think it makes it a lot more approachable and a lot more foundational, right? I think you'll be able to build more off of it. And other people that are experiencing your stories, I think, will be able to see themselves within it more readily versus if it's something that just only you can make sense of, right? Or only people who think like you can make sense of, right? If you don't really talk about the structures behind how your world works and why it works, then you're unlikely to be able to bring over people who don't usually think about things that way. You have to couch things, like I said, in the familiar. So you can show how things came from where the world we live in now and led to, you know, the world that you're trying to create. And yeah, I'm going to be practicing this myself. I have no idea exactly how I'm going to make it happen, but I'm excited to do so. But yeah, and I'll end it there, I suppose. Maybe next time I'll talk about some stuff about XR and what else I've been doing this week. But I hope it was an interesting episode, as always. And as always, don't be afraid to be radical. Don't be afraid to be revolutionary. Keep being awesome. Love yourself. Love others. And let me know if you ever want to talk about these things together. And I hope... Oh, here's one thing I wanted to say that came to mind when I was in bed this morning, waking up for some reason. I hope that... one thing that was in the podcast about identity and the self was that we bring a whole new world to every conversation, to every, you know, relationship, right? And we bring all of our relationships to, you know, every conversation that we have, right? Whenever you're talking with somebody else, you're not just bringing who, quote unquote, or the in order to bring who you are, you have to bring what you are, right? All the relationships that you've had that make up who you are. And so you have an entire world of relationships that you're bringing to the table. And that other person has an entire world of relationships that they're bringing to the table whenever you meet them. And so think about that whenever you're talking with folks. But also realize that, you know, you're also changing that person. And you're also being changed, right? With each conversation that you have, with each piece of relationship that you have, or each new relationship that you have, and even old ones, right? Even constant ones. Every conversation you have, right? You're becoming a new person because you're bringing in a new thing into your world. However that conversation went, it's still changing your world, right? Because it's adding to it in some way. And I wanted to leave off with this. I like to imagine that. This podcast, this stuff I do, will exist for hundreds, if not thousands of years, or even longer. And there might exist somebody listening to this who's currently on a spaceship of some sort, who's traveling the vast expanse of space. And I hope that you're able to translate this or understand this in some way. Somehow you're able to get all this data from these weird ass devices that we've had and we have in the 21st century on Earth. And somehow you're able to to grasp a lot of what I'm saying, even though it's maybe very far from the type of life you live. But nonetheless, I hope that you're looking out upon the stars and smiling, or whatever the equivalent of that is for you, and that you're getting you're being tickled that, you know, your life is changing right now from somebody who lived countless years in the past that you may never see in person, but it's nonetheless, you know, changing a little bit about your life. I don't know, I've said that poorly. It was much cooler in my head. This is another reason why I want to do what I want to do. But I don't know, something about that tickles me. Probably not even going to happen, but in the unlikely case that it does, I hope, you know, this inspires you to continue this conversation countless years in the future, so that we can all be immortal in different ways, right? And hopefully you say that much better than I do. Anyways, yeah. Have a good one. I'll see you another time. Hopefully some part of myself lives on in the far future. Somewhere out there in the multiverse. Have a great day. See you. Bye-bye.